Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Saturday, April 18th, and we're diving deep today with our Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition. I'm Maya, and alongside me, as always, is Alex.
Great to be here, Maya. In a packed edition it is. Feels a little like running a full diagnostic scan on the global system right now, doesn't it? So many vital signs to check.
Always with the medical analogies, Alex. But you're not wrong. Let's start with markets. Are we seeing a fundamental disconnect or simply a recalibration? We'll unpack alternative strategies investors are eyeing, because business as usual is clearly off the table.
Worth noting, then, we're shifting gears to geopolitics, specifically the knock-on effects on energy markets. I'm genuinely curious to hear your take on whether the current volatility is a blip or the new normal.
Normal is a construct, Alex. But speaking of constructs, are we truly prepared for the economic ripples of widening inequality and the systemic risks it creates?
That's a huge question. And while the economy feels unstable, the pace of change in AI is relentless. Coding arms race, workflow revolution, it's moving fast.
Faster than you can say disruption. And finally, we're tackling the regulatory frontier. Crypto's future, decentralization's limits, Alex. I still think you're overly optimistic on Bitcoin's longevity.
Challenge accepted. Let's get into it.
Rob Carver's portfolio returned 23.7% last year. Seriously, 23.7% while the world felt like it was actively ending. Let's talk about this disconnect, markets looking calm despite everything, and what strategies are actually working.
That performance figure is striking, and it immediately highlights the power of trend following in the current environment. The data from SI396 suggests the gains were concentrated in specific periods, late May to October and December to January, but the core point is that these strategies were profitable while traditional risk-off narratives were dominating headlines.
Profitable but also weird. We're seeing futures prices diverge from physical prices, like oil in Sri Lanka at $286 a barrel versus $90 to $100 for WTI. That's not just a slight premium, that's a completely different reality.
There's a signal here that divergence isn't a bug, it's a feature revealing hidden complexities. As Carver points out, standard futures trading abstracts away localized supply shocks and delivery challenges. It creates potential risks for those unaware of these realities, a reminder that market indices aren't always representative of actual conditions.
So a global investor buys an oil ETF thinking they're hedged, but they're actually exposed to a very specific, potentially distorted price point.
That's a simplified but accurate depiction. The ETF landscape is evolving with the introduction of performance fees, which is a positive step toward aligning incentives, but managed futures ETFs still have limitations. They offer comparable performance to traditional CTAs, but with constraints.
Constraints like what exactly?
Replication CTAs, for instance, are being questioned. Standard indexes don't always include interest income, which can significantly inflate returns. Carver's research shows this can add up to 300 basis points, skewing performance comparisons.
So you're saying the numbers we see for these alternative investments are potentially fluffed?
That's a strong word, but there's a clear argument for that. Simplification of strategies reduces investment edge, and it's often difficult to fully account for these hidden factors. Combining equity portfolios with trend following, however, consistently proves effective, more effective than trying to replace equities altogether.
That's comforting. It's not about abandoning stocks, it's about adding a layer of protection. But cash efficiency is a huge factor, right?
Critical. Futures contracts allow for return stacking, buying risk with cash at a much higher efficiency than traditional methods. Carver illustrates this with the comparison of 25 to 35% cash usage for 15% vol risk in CTAs versus 100% for short-duration bonds. It's a fundamentally different allocation possibility, allowing for a potentially four times bigger pizza, as he puts it.
A four times bigger pizza, okay, I'm sticking with that analogy. But isn't scaling a problem? If everyone piles into trend following, doesn't it just stop working?
That's a valid concern, and diversification is key. Quantica's research highlights that the problem isn't finding a high Sharpe ratio alternative, but identifying strategies with room to scale, meaning they behave differently and are cash efficient enough to meaningfully add to a portfolio.
Right, you need something that's actually different, not just a crowded trade.
We can trace that further. Carver's annual performance review, aligned with the UK tax year, reinforces this point. Pure trend following outperformed his broader signal-based approach due to favorable market conditions, but that's not guaranteed every year.
So timing matters. And it's not just about the strategy itself.
Oh, here's the picture. Specific timeframes are crucial for evaluating CTA strategies. And interestingly, slow trend signals are proving effective. This suggests a shift in market dynamics, where longer-term trends are more profitable than rapid reactions.
Wait, slow trend. Everyone's always talking about algorithms and high-frequency trading. You're saying slower is better.
The data suggests that, yes. It challenges the common assumption that faster signals are always superior. And this performance is largely derived from tedious operational details, managing slippage, diversifying into numerous markets, accurately estimating costs, and avoiding overfitting.
Tidy as. I love that. It's less about clever signals and more about grunt work.
Consider this, consistent gains come from rigorous operational management. And optimizing a portfolio for crisis alpha requires a holistic approach, not just within the CTA strategy. Integrating CTAs with bonds and equities calls for reducing risk weighting in those existing exposures, and potentially increasing the speed and trend component of the CTA to better navigate equity shocks.
So you don't just add trend following, you adjust everything else around it.
Correct. It's about joint optimization. And as you add CTAs to a portfolio, it's important to realize diversifying isn't about finding a strategy with a high Sharpe ratio, it's about cash efficiency.
Okay, we've established trend following is good, ETFs are evolving, and slow is the new fast. What about oils? Are we heading for $300 a barrel?
The oil price disconnect, specifically the example of Sri Lanka trading at $286, reveals a hidden complexity. The market currently underestimates the localized supply shocks that are driving that divergence.
The geopolitical risk isn't priced in globally, it's localized.
It appears that way. And the managed futures ETF space, while growing, remains constrained by mathematical limitations, the simplification tax, as Carver calls it. While ETFs can serve as poor man's CTAs, trade-offs impact performance.
Meaning they're good, but not the real deal. What about all this talk about AI? How does that factor in?
AI is a double-edged sword. It can improve signal generation, but also exacerbate overfitting and complexity. The key takeaway from the SI-396 discussion is that consistent gains come from operational details, not clever algorithms.
AI is more hype than substance in the CTA space.
That's a fair characterization, at least currently. There's a risk of focusing on flashy technology at the expense of rigorous risk management. In the nascent market for usage ETFs with performance fees, as opposed to the flat fee structure of traditional ETFs, represents a crucial shift towards aligning incentives between investors and managers, potentially attracting capital to strategies demonstrating consistent returns.
Okay, that's actually optimistic. So better ETFs, better incentives, slow trend following, and cash efficiency. Is that the gist of it?
That's a concise summary. And it's worth noting that while intraday trading is touted as a benefit of ETFs, Carver argues it's unnecessary for long-term investments and may even be detrimental. He advocates for a simpler NAV-based approach mirroring offshore hedge funds.
This is so anti-everything I thought I knew about trading. It's honestly unbelievable.
It challenges conventional wisdom. Ultimately, cost predictability outweighs performance randomness in trading strategy evaluation. Costs are consistently predictable year over year and should receive greater weight than performance, which is inherently random.
So focus on the fees, not the headline gains.
That's a counterintuitive but more reliable metric. And looking forward, the key will be integrating CTAs into a broader portfolio framework. A pure trend-following portfolio should maximize Sharpe ratio, but integrating it with bonds and equities calls for adjusting risk weighting in those existing exposures.
All right, let's make a bet. We're 6 months out, so by October 18th, I predict the S&P 500 will be down 5% from its current all-time high, driven by a re-acceleration of inflationary pressures and a localized energy price shock.
A bold prediction. I'll counter with the VIX exceeding 20 by October 18th, driven by increased volatility in the energy sector, indicating that the market's current complacency is unwarranted. Let's revisit this in the fall.
So the Iran conflict, or rather the ongoing blockade of the Strait of Hormuz. It feels like we're watching two opposing forces collide, a desperate attempt to maintain control over oil flow versus a deliberate effort to redefine energy security. Alex, if you had to bet on which one wins out, which way do you lean?
The latter, undoubtedly. It's not about restoring the status quo ante anymore. The war began in February 2026, triggering a 20% shortage in oil and LNG, exceeding the disruption from Russia-Ukraine. That scale of physical scarcity fundamentally shifts the equation. This isn't just a price spike, it's a tangible lack of supply disrupting 40% of global trade routes.
Right. And disruption is a euphemism for, well, things not arriving. Jamie Smythe pointed out this is unprecedented because it's not merely a market reaction, but a straight-up logistical chokehold.
And the fact that the U.S., despite being the world's largest producer, is seeing higher gas prices due to Asian demand underscores the interconnectedness. Mike Summers' focus on reopening Hormuz reflects that. U.S. energy independence, pioneered by the Sheffields, doesn't guarantee immunity. It makes the U.S. a central redistributor of shocks.
A very expensive redistributor, apparently. So shale saved us to allow us to feel the pain globally.
Perhaps buffered is a more accurate term. But the core point is that the shale revolution's impact is now modulated by geopolitical events. Scott Sheffield's advocacy for an international force to secure the Strait points to that reality, and he's not speaking hypothetically, he's drawing on personal experience.
Personal experience involving potential negotiation strategies. Convenient, but let's talk infrastructure. The reports suggest Qatar's LNG facilities are going to take 3 to 5 years to fully recover.
That's the critical point. While a quick restoration of some supply is possible, Natasha Kaneva mentioned 2 weeks to Asia, 35 to Europe. Full capacity recovery is a multi-layered process. Ports, tanker companies, pilots, seafarer unions, it's a cascade of dependencies.
A cascade of logistical nightmares. We also have the aluminum situation brewing. Greg Shearer called the supply disruption a point of no return because of the Bahrain and Abu Dhabi facility damage.
It's a telling detail. A 2 million ton deficit, the largest since 2008, is asymmetric. Escalation worsens it, mitigation only limits the existing loss. It's an event horizon in his framing. Unlike oil, where demand destruction is a potential offset, aluminum faces a sustained supply crisis.
So oil has a pressure release valve, aluminum does not. It's a cheerful thought. Europe predictably is already feeling the squeeze with inflation rising.
Something to flag here, it's not just Europe. The trade disruptions, a reduction from 150 ships a day to 5 to 10, extend far beyond oil, impacting resources like fertilizers and metals. That's why Bruce Kasman and Joseph Lupton anticipated a modest energy price shock, but expected the strait to reopen, reducing downside risks.
Modest, right? That assumes central banks are capable of rational thought.
The counterintuitive dynamic is that initial hawkishness, driven by oil price fears, may ease with stable prices. But that stability could lull them into complacency, overestimating the need for tightening, as Kasman highlights.
So they panic about the oil shock, then ignore it when it doesn't materialize while everything else burns.
It's a risk. Tributing price increases to demand, rather than supply, fundamentally alters macroeconomic interpretation. If central banks believe demand is the driver, they'll respond differently.
The Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds continue to deploy capital into private markets even during the war. Lisa Abramovitz's point about a long-term investment horizon is unnerving.
It reveals a counterintuitive resilience. They aren't deterred by geopolitical instability. It's a signal that they're positioning for the long term, regardless of the current conflict. And the London Stock Exchange's strong pipeline since 2005 suggests that capital continues to flow.
Capital flows through chaos. What about solutions? Scott Sheffield anticipates NATO involvement, even troop deployment. A concrete escalation scenario.
That's significant. It's not simply about reopening the strait, it's about securing it militarily. Mike Summers privately advocated for boots on the ground, revealing a consensus within the oil industry on forceful intervention, despite initial reluctance. Jamie Smythe highlights this as previously unacknowledged.
The oil industry wanted the war to go away until it realized it needed soldiers.
A shift in priorities driven by the physical shortage. And the U.S. strategy, as described by Laura Davison, is a blockade of the blockade, attempting to create a perception of Iranian pragmatism through economic pressure.
Roy Cohening Iran into submission. It sounds optimistic.
It relies on the threat of damage to their oil wells. But Iran's hardline leadership appears willing to endure hardship rather than concede, as Stephen Cook notes. The 10-day ceasefire in Lebanon is fragile, and its collapse could derail wider negotiations.
So what breaks next?
Downstream infrastructure. Qatar's LNG facilities won't be fully restored for years. While Saudi Arabia can scale back production relatively quickly, the facilities requiring extensive rebuilds represent a prolonged bottleneck. And that ultimately is the single biggest implication. The vulnerability of critical infrastructure, specifically LNG production, will redefine energy security strategies for the foreseeable future.
Which conveniently creates a financial incentive for pipeline projects, even if they're economically dubious. That leads us nicely into our next segment, economic resilience, inequality, and systemic risks. I'm going to say something provocative. The U.S. tax code isn't broken, it's working exactly as intended for a very specific group of people. Let's talk about that group and how the system shields them.
That's a bracing claim, Maya, but I think there's real merit to it. The core issue isn't accidental complexity, but deliberate construction to favor investment income over earned income, a reversal championed by figures like Andrew W. Mellon, and it's created a dynamic where wealth begets wealth, largely untaxed until liquidation. We see the ultra-wealthy accepting low salaries, relying on stock appreciation, and constantly borrowing against assets.
Mellon thought wage earners were precarious. That's quite a justification for letting capital gains run wild. 32% of the country's wealth held by the top 1% feels less like a policy failure and more like the plan succeeding.
The pattern is clear. It's not just a matter of income strategy. The estate tax, often touted as a check on dynastic wealth, is riddled with loopholes. Minority discounts, dynasty trusts, grant or retained annuity trusts, estate planners have spent decades actively finding ways around it, and Congress hasn't kept pace since 1990. The 122,000 estate tax returns in 2000 plummeting to 2,584 in 2021 isn't about fewer rich people dying. It's a systematic gutting of the system.
A gutting is a polite way to put it. It feels less like an estate tax and more like a wealth preservation service disguised as a tax. The 18 families, the Mars, Kochs, Waltons, actively campaigned to discredit it, framing it as a threat to family farms, which is a demonstrably false narrative.
And it worked. Framing it as punishing the rich is counterproductive. Focusing on universal tax obligation and system integrity is far more effective. But even attempting a wealth tax faces constitutional hurdles, as Ray Madoff points out. It's theoretically possible, but politically fraught. What strikes me is the dance between taxpayers and the government, a relentless cycle of loophole creation and closure.
It's like a high-stakes game of whack-a-mole. The 1986 Tax Reform Act is a rare example of success, broadening the base and reducing shelters, but that took political will. It seems like the incentive structure favors maintaining the status quo, with politicians benefiting from the support of those who exploit these loopholes, as Ezra Clanch highlights.
The 1986 Act is crucial. But consider the historical parallel with philanthrocapitalism. The book reveals a moment when the wealthy's actions weren't scrutinized. Now, with wealth concentration at 31.7 to 32%, public awareness is increasing, and the facade of charitable giving is crumbling. The current tax code actively incentivizes wealth accumulation outside of traditional income, specifically through stock ownership.
Tax-free form of wealth is a good way to put it. Borrowing against stock holdings to fund lifestyles without triggering a taxable event. That feels less like financial ingenuity and more like a blatant loophole. Lenders happily extending credit because there's minimal risk, it's a self-perpetuating cycle.
And the estate tax is, ironically, strategically maintained by the wealthy because its loopholes are so beneficial. The appearance of compliance shields them from more substantive reform. It's a facade, as Ray Madoff observed. Repeal attempts stalled in 2025 because loopholes are more valuable than outright elimination.
So the tax itself is a distraction. A symbolic gesture to appease public outcry while the real work of wealth preservation happens behind the scenes.
The data tells a story. Look at Jeff Bezos. Strategically avoiding traditional salaries, accumulating benefits through stock appreciation, it's not simply aligning interests with the company. It's a deliberate strategy to avoid income and payroll taxes. The system is literally written out of it, as Ezra Clancho said.
It's like the Silk Road, but instead of goods, it's capital flowing through a network of offshore accounts and legal maneuvers, avoiding tolls at every turn.
An apt comparison, actually. That network relies on complexity. And complexity creates an uneven playing field. Charitable vehicles, while appearing philanthropic, are frequently used for tax-free transfers and political influence. Even the angel of death loophole, the step-up in basis, rewards wealth transfer over earned income.
And even if we manage to untangle those knots, a wealth tax faces logistical hurdles like valuation and potential relocation of assets. Canada's system of taxing gains upon transfer, sale, gift, or death feels like a more viable alternative.
It's a workable model, forcing taxation when wealth changes hands. But even that requires political will. And as Clancho points out, enforcement is as crucial as design. A reformed code is useless without sustained effort to prevent loopholes.
Which brings us back to the influence of the ultra-wealthy. They're not just avoiding taxes, they're actively shaping the rules of the game. The $100 billion transfer without reporting while $100 in cash triggers scrutiny. That's a fundamental inequity.
And the declining estate tax returns are a symptom. The system isn't broken, it's functioning as designed for those with the resources to exploit it. We're seeing a shift in public perception, however, and that's creating pressure. Framing the issue as fairness, a situation where residents of one state don't pay taxes, is more effective than moral judgments about the rich.
A top 10% tax schema, a holistic approach encompassing income, wealth, capital gains, and corporate income, feels like the only way to address this. But that requires confronting the core problem of concentrated political power. The 1986 Act proves meaningful reform is possible, but it involved a politically powerful group participating.
And the current push for wealth taxes is fueled by this shift in perception. But even if we can achieve it, it's essential to remember that the tax gap isn't widespread evasion. It's a systematic imbalance where W-2 earners are penalized for compliance. And tax design is distinct from the will to enforce it, meaning a reformed tax code is useless without sustained effort to prevent loopholes and evasion.
Ultimately, the goal isn't necessarily punishment, but restoring a sense of fairness. But it's hard to see that happening when the system incentivizes wealth accumulation and actively shields those at the top. And if this all sounds bleak, consider this. The escalating cost of tax preparation services, rising faster than any other line item in the CPI, suggests the complexity burdens everyone, not just the wealthy.
That's a revealing data point, isn't it? Perhaps the ultimate indictment of the system is that even simplicity, just filing taxes, is becoming an unaffordable luxury. The next frontier, it seems, isn't just about reforming taxes, but about ensuring everyone can understand them. And that's a battle being fought in parallel with the growing sophistication of AI's workflow automation and the need to redesign labor itself.
94 times higher code churn. That's a lot. It seems like the AI coding revolution isn't exactly code complete.
It's a deceptively simple metric. The initial burst of code generation from tools like Codex is misleading. The real story is in the revisions. The data from Faro AI, 9.4 times higher churn for AI users, highlights that these tools aren't replacing engineers so much as creating a more iterative workflow, and that workflow is more demanding. It points to the importance of owning the entire workflow, not just the initial code spit out.
So it's less AI writes code and more AI drafts code that engineers then spend a ridiculous amount of time fixing.
Stepping back, that's where OpenAI and Anthropic are strategically diverging. OpenAI is aggressively expanding its plugin ecosystem, 111 integrations at launch for Codex, attempting to overcome reliance on browser workarounds that Anthropic's cloud code currently faces. It's a move to establish that complete ecosystem control, making Codex the central hub instead of a standalone tool.
Cloud Cowork forces you back into Chrome like some kind of digital indentured servitude. A deliberate choice, though, right? Anthropic isn't aiming to be the everything app.
Correct. Anthropic is moving up the stack, mirroring OpenAI's strategy but with a different philosophy. Claude design, useful even for non-designers, and agentic plugins demonstrate their ambition to own the complete user workflow, offering end-to-end solutions rather than just API access. They're betting on platform, not model as a service.
Speaking of platforms, Factory's $1.5 billion valuation is pretty wild in this landscape. Everyone's building AI coding tools, so why are VCs throwing money at enterprise compliance?
It signals a critical market gap, niche specialization. Factory is addressing a need individual developer tools can't, enterprise-grade security and compliance. The success is validation that VCs recognize the value of targeting specific requirements, even in a crowded space. This isn't a winner-take-all scenario, it's about serving specialized demands.
It's like saying, yes, anyone can make a car, but only we build armored limousines for people who are actively afraid of everything.
That's a surprisingly apt analogy. And it extends beyond code. Physical intelligence's Pi 0.7, with its ability to complete tasks without specific training, is another piece of this workflow puzzle. It's showing promising results in generalist robotics, and they're in talks to nearly double their valuation to $11 billion, indicating a broader trend toward automated execution of tasks.
Okay, so AI is drafting the code, Anthropic and OpenAI are fighting over who owns the editor, and robots are learning to operate air fryers. What does all this add up to?
It's about a shift in the nature of knowledge work. The new Codex app isn't just a coding tool. It's positioned as a chief of staff for individual users, handling broader tasks and automating complex processes. Jason Liu's recipe, emphasizing persistent context and continuous interviewing, shows how to build that architecture.
My calendar gets managed by a slightly judgmental AI that judges my priorities and subtly implies I'm wasting my life.
Potentially. The Heartbeats feature directly embodies the idea that a helpful AI teammate remembers past interactions, learning from OpenClaw, rather than starting from scratch each time. More crucially, though, they're realizing you need to evaluate these models on novel use cases. Nick Bauman's work teammate thread is a perfect example. He's using it as a benchmark to filter noise and proactively prioritize tasks, something previously unfeasible.
Let's say they solve the chief of staff problem, build these perfect AI workflow orchestrators. What happens then? If everything is automated, what does Cognizant's 350,000 employee workforce do?
That's the core uncertainty, isn't it? The observed pattern of companies bragging about token usage, which turns out to be a misleading productivity indicator, suggests a fundamental misunderstanding of the value proposition. Initial code acceptance rates drop from 80 to 90% to 10 to 30% after 2 weeks, revealing the magnitude of the rewriting process and the need for improved code quality validation. We're building a system that generates work, not necessarily solutions. It's a destabilizing force without a clear plan for the aftermath. We don't know what a world with automated workflows looks like, and frankly, the AI companies don't seem to either. And that's precisely why the public distrust is rising, declining trust in both AI and government regulation, because the risks aren't being adequately addressed.
So we're automating ourselves into chaos, potentially governed by an AI that subtly resents our poor time management. Sounds like a perfect segue into the regulatory frontier, especially with how crypto is trying to solve similar problems, albeit with a very different toolkit. A 30% success rate. That's the baseline probability of winning a crypto case, even with strong legal representation. Let's talk about the regulatory frontier, specifically how the legal system is, shall we say, grappling with decentralization.
It's a fundamental mismatch of frameworks. The DOJ and SEC are built to address entities, hierarchies, clear lines of responsibility. Early crypto projects like BitCloud intentionally avoided that structure, and that creates immediate friction. Laura Shin's experience demonstrates that even acting in good faith, adherence to legal guidelines isn't enough.
Good faith. She literally got a DNA swab because of a clerical error during a DOJ investigation. It sounds less like good faith and more like shoot first, ask questions later.
The implication runs deeper. The debanking issues and initial financial flows, funds routed through Shin's personal account, became the focal point, despite being a pragmatic response to systemic barriers. The optics of suspicion trump the underlying intent to build a decentralized system, and that's a pattern we're seeing.
The very act of decentralization can be your biggest legal liability.
In a way, yes. The DOJ's initial case against Shin hinged on misinterpreting her intentions regarding decentralization, seeing the temporary corporate entity as a contradiction. It highlights the danger of incomplete information, or frankly, a lack of understanding of the operational constraints faced by these projects.
And then the SEC case against DSO dismissed with prejudice in March 2026, after Shin refused a settlement. That sounds less like a legal victory and more like a grudging admission of weakness.
It's indicative of a deeper resistance within the agency. Shin's lawyers described it as unusually weak, requiring internal advocacy up the chain, and a shift in approach likely facilitated by Brian Armstrong's Fair Shake PAC. The SEC seemingly mischaracterized her spending, classifying office rent as personal expenses.
Meaning the definition of security is malleable.
Highly. And the SEC's slower response a full year after the DOJ dismissal suggests an ideological divide. The proposed Bitcoin upgrade to freeze Satoshi's coins, BIP-361, parallels this struggle, as it requires a level of centralized action fundamentally at odds with Bitcoin's core principles.
A genius act, according to Kyne Warwick, to address a latent risk and provide justification for proactive security measures. But doesn't that just open a new regulatory can of worms?
Two things stand out. It creates a forcing function for Satoshi to reveal themselves, but more importantly, it highlights the lack of clear legal frameworks and enforcement mechanisms. Curve's lawsuit from May 2020, investors sending money with no contractual recourse, demonstrates the vulnerability. Looking ahead, by 2028, we'll likely see an explosion of litigation around token agreements. I predict we'll see a major court case attempting to define investor rights in a genuinely decentralized system, and the outcome will be pivotal.
Circling back on everything, the trend followers making hay, the oil price schizophrenia, AI churning code at 94 times the rate, and the crypto world still battling for legitimacy, it feels like we're seeing the same underlying story play out from very different angles. It's not just about isolated events, is it? It's about a system straining to represent reality.
Two things stand out. It's a cascading series of reflections of increasingly localized disruptions. We spoke earlier about how the numbers for these alternative investments are potentially optimistic, relying on conditions that may not persist. That's the core issue. Conventional macro signals are getting distorted by these very localized shocks. Energy price divergences like Sri Lanka paying $286 versus WTI at $90, wealth concentration skewing estate tax data, even the arbitrary enforcement in the crypto space. The system is reacting to symptoms, not the disease.
And those localized shocks are often geopolitically driven. We're not in a new normal for energy security. We're in a constant reassessment phase, reacting to events rather than proactively building resilience. You pointed out the 300 basis point simplification tax on managed futures. It's a cost for trying to operate within a framework that doesn't account for this inherent unpredictability.
And the AI piece complicates things further. It isn't eliminating jobs outright, but it's introducing a layer of operational complexity, demanding a kind of chief of staff to manage the workflow. It's augmenting, yes, but it's also amplifying the need for rigorous oversight and signal filtering. And even that has a cost, as the code churn data illustrates. More iterations don't necessarily equal more efficient development. It's like running a cryptographic hash function. You're looking for patterns within noise, but the complexity increases exponentially with each input.
Which brings us back to blockchain. The inherent tension between its decentralized nature and the legal system's need for centralized enforcement. That Curve lawsuit from 2020 feels like a harbinger of things to come, shoot first, ask questions later enforcement, trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. And the proposed BIP-361, freezing Satoshi's coins, it's a forcing function, demanding a conversation about investor rights in a distributed environment.
It's about establishing trust in a system where trust is fundamentally different. The prediction of a legal battle defining crypto investor rights by 2028 feels increasingly inevitable, but the outcome is far from certain. And the broader pattern suggests a 5% decline in the S&P 500 by October, fueled by those inflationary pressures and localized energy shocks. The VIX exceeding 20 feels like a reasonable expectation.
So what are we watching? The central bank's response to these supply-side shocks, the scaling of trend following, the true impact of AI on workflow, and the possibility of geopolitical intervention in energy supply routes.
And the growing pressure on Satoshi Nakamoto. It's a strange confluence of forces, but ultimately, a test of whether we can build systems that accurately reflect the underlying complexity of the world, or whether we'll continue to rely on increasingly fluffed metrics and arbitrary interventions.
Thanks for joining us. We'll be back tomorrow to continue running a full diagnostic scan on the global system.